Hi, and welcome to another episode of The Advocacy Channel, a customer marketing podcast. I'm your host, Will Fraser, and this is our 22nd episode. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Emily Amos to the show. Emily is the founder and CEO at Uplift Content Inc., a content marketing agency for B2B SaaS specializing in case studies, ebooks, and blog posts. Emily joins us today to provide insights on developing effective B2B SaaS case studies. In this episode, we delve into the key findings from Emily's recent research offering strategies to enhance your case studies. We hope you enjoy this episode. Welcome, Emily. So thank you so much for joining us on the show here today.
Thanks, Will. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, I think our guests are going to really enjoy this show. But now, before we kind of jump into the meat of our topic today, you know, maybe you can just kind of give us a little bit of a career background and give me some context as to what it is that got you into content marketing for B2B SaaS.
Sure. So as you mentioned, I'm the CEO and founder of a small content marketing agency, and we focus on B2B SaaS. So we write case studies, ebooks, blog posts, those sorts of things. As I'm sure most people's journeys, mine is winding and long, but the Coles notes would be, I spent my 20s having fun, gallivanting around the world. I studied linguistics at university, so I went off and taught English as a second language in a few different places, including New Zealand and France. I came back home to Nova Scotia on the east coast of Canada and continued teaching ESL, but quickly realized, you know what, as I got closer to hitting the big 3-0, that teaching just wasn't going to be a long-term career for me. And I was getting really frustrated with feeling like I had no control over my career, my schedule, my income, et cetera. So I thought, okay, well, I guess I need to be self-employed, even though I had sworn to my parents that I would never be self-employed because they were self-employed. And I saw how it takes over your life. And they would always talk about work at the dinner table. And so I was kind of doing a complete 360 by saying, okay, I guess I need to be self-employed. And I know my parents probably got a huge kick out of it because I always said I would never do it. So anyway, I thought, okay, well, what can I do? I knew that I was a decent writer. So I said, why not? Let's be a freelance writer. I think when you're young, it's easy to just try things. I didn't have any, you know, I didn't have a mortgage. I didn't have kids. It was a kind of a low risk thing to do at the time. So I became a freelance writer. It was hard. It was a huge slog to kind of get my business up and running and to find customers. Eventually that happened. 10 years later, I realized, you know what? I love running a business, but I don't really love writing. So I'm going to change the model and become an agency. I will run the business. I'll do the sales and marketing. I'll do the operations, but I'm going to have a team of freelance writers and editors do the day-to-day writing and editing work. So that's what led to creating Uplift Content. We're now 6 years in, and we're really excited with where we are. I'm personally excited with what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis. Why B2B SaaS? I wish I had a better answer for you, but I had a colleague, an acquaintance kind of connect me with a B2B SaaS company when I was still on my own as a freelancer, and I landed them as a customer. So I had one B2B SaaS company as a customer, and I thought, well, if I have one, I can find one more. And if I can find one more, I can find two, et cetera, et cetera. So also, I guess, as a marketer, I knew that I needed to be more niche so that I could more easily market myself, have a more specific message, et cetera. So that's where I came from.
I love the reality there that, you know, if you find that first customer and you just keep building on it. I have a friend who's got a very fun story, but, you know, at some point you just ask, what will you buy from me? And once you find that, you just kind of keep keep pushing along. That's really exciting. And like you said, the windy path, I think, is the normal path, it seems, these days. It's rare that we get to talk to someone who's had a straight line path in this field. So totally makes sense to me.
I mean, what kid is going to say, oh, yeah, I'm gonna own a content marketing company when I'm older?
I mean, honestly, the number of kids that I talk to that want to be content creators, I don't know if they quite would call it the same thing, but maybe by the time that they're there, they'll already been doing it. I don't know. We'll
true,
see.
True, true, true.
You know, I think what we really wanted to dig into here today, which is really exciting, is that you just did a really robust study, research study on case studies, which is kind of a fun way to look at it here. But, you know, maybe you can kind of give us just a quick overview of this case study, how you approached it, what your objectives were, and then we can dive into some of the data.
Yeah, sure. So we're actually going on to our third year of doing this study. So we started it in 2022 and we have one this year, but we're in the works of getting our survey ready for the 2024 report. And it's been really interesting. You know, the very first one was tough because we didn't know what we were doing. And, but you know, things do get easier the more you practice. And when you learn lessons, I feel like as an entrepreneur, you learn everything the hard way. yeah. So yeah, I've done that. but we decided to do this original research for a few different reasons. Firstly, we had a bunch of questions about case studies that we didn't necessarily have answers to. And we knew that our customers also had similar questions. So we thought, okay, well, let's find out the answers to these questions. Secondly, especially now with AI and mass produced content, we all know that original research is kind of one of the ways to differentiate yourself and to help your content stand out. So that was important for us. We wanted to be seen as experts on case studies. So, you know, again, having original research and thought leadership content around that was something that appealed to us. And 90% of our leads come through SEO. So we really wanted to use the report to attract backlinks to our website to help build our domain authority. And funnily enough, lead generation was at the very bottom of our list.
Oh, interesting. You know, it's interesting. One of the things I've heard when people are trying to put together these reports is just how challenging it can be to actually find respondents, or at least find quality respondents. Did you use an outside agency to source that, or did you do it yourself? And if you did it yourself, kind of how did that work?
Great question. So the first year was painful. You know, I promoted it on LinkedIn to my network. I sent individual messages to connections that I had on LinkedIn, so customer marketers or customer advocates who might be responsible for case studies and therefore able to respond to the survey. But it was a tough slog. And in the end, we were aiming for 100 respondents. That's what we had been told is, you know, you kind of need 100 to make it statistically valid. So we were at about 70 and we just weren't getting the last 30. So I did go to a panel company and pay for that remaining 30, but the quality was not where we would have wanted it to be. Yeah. Luckily, last year was a lot easier. I really tapped into getting people that I knew well to share it to their networks. So that kind of influencer marketing idea. And that really helped. And certainly, you know, I was building on some momentum from the previous year. So it was much easier last year, and I'm hoping it'll be even easier this year.
Fair enough. Hopefully it just kind of keeps building on itself for sure. One of the numbers that we found really interesting when looking at this research is that you found that, you know, 75% of companies are including metrics in their case studies. I've personally seen, you know, numbers for numbers' sake, I think, and I've seen numbers that really kind of draw me in. What's kind of your view there, and what differentiates like a good metric, a great metric? You know, how do you look at metrics as a whole when it comes to the case study format?
I agree. There's this huge pressure to get kind of those three standout metrics at the top of your case study. We've all seen them. And when they are good. They're really good. Numbers that don't matter are things like how many offices you have or how many customers you have. Like, that really doesn't matter. And people can see through that. What I would say is a great metric is one that will resonate with your readers. So you really have to think about who your audience is and what kind of number matters to them. So for example, if you're talking about 100 hours saved, that might be something that a CFO would care about, but maybe not a software engineer, because the CFO cares about ROI and cost savings. But the software engineer, for them, what might resonate more would be something like a 25% reduction in support tickets, because the support tickets for them are a hassle and it takes them away from the stuff that they really want to be working on. And maybe it's 100 hours savings as well. So maybe it's essentially the same number, but we need to talk about it in a different way, in a way that resonates for the audience that your case study is for. One other thing that I wanted to say about metrics is that you need to provide enough context around the number for it to be meaningful. So sometimes if you just have a number, it doesn't really mean anything because you don't know kind of the before state or the after state. And so, for example, going back to the 100 hours saved, okay, that might be considered a good metric, but a great metric would be that the team is 25% more efficient because of that 100 hour savings. And that means they can reduce their headcount by 2 people and that saves them 2 salaries. So that might be a great metric because it's more specific, there's context around it, and it's more concrete. You can kind of picture it in a more tangible way. One last piece that I found interesting from the results of our survey last year is that we found that marketers are really doubling down on how important they think metrics are for case studies. They found that metrics are the number one factor for how they decide whether they're going to tell this story as a case study. But 70% of them say that finding impactful metrics or getting impactful metrics is the number one biggest challenge when writing a case study. So on the one hand, they're saying it's incredibly important. And on the other hand, they're saying, but it's also our biggest challenge. And so I think what comes from that is, okay, so where do you get your metrics from? Who do you ask? When do you ask? And when we asked that in our survey, 88% of the respondents say that they ask for metrics during the case study interview. And I found that really interesting because I actually totally disagree with doing it during the interview. I think, yes, you ask during the interview, but you need to ask ahead of time. You need to prepare them and let them know that you will be asking them about it during the interview. But if I ask you on the spot, Will, what's your ROI for a podcast? There's no way you can tell me that number. But perhaps if I give you a couple of days to kind of dig around in your numbers, maybe you could give me something during the interview. And I think that's really important to remember. We want to set our customers up for success. We want them to be the hero of the story. We don't want them to fail and crash and burn during the interview. That doesn't make anybody feel good. So give them time to find those numbers for you. And then the other thing would be, think about how your business is set up in the first place for software. How can you build metric collection into the software itself so that as a company, you have access to some of those metrics? And then secondly, during the customer onboarding process, is there an opportunity for the customer success manager to sit down with the new customer and set some benchmarks, some goals and KPIs to be aiming for so that you can do a before and after down the road?
You know, I really like that idea. You know, it's kind of like, let's start with the case study in mind, or at least let's have it in mind when the client starts with us. And it is always a challenge. I know I've experienced that before, where you ask people for numbers and there's just getting a specific number or a number that they're confident in sharing. is always interesting. I know we've seen it before where we have clients who they're okay with a percentage version, but not an absolute version of a number or something like that. So there's also seems to be a bit of negotiating the presentation layer with the client as well. But I definitely like that idea of starting with the client or sorry, with the case study in mind, whether you're building your software or engaging that customer.
And honestly, it goes so further beyond just a case study. It's going to help you with retention, with cross sell and upsell. The case study is just a tiny little piece of it. Having those numbers is how you're going to keep them as a customer.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, it's interesting. We're talking about the metrics. We're talking about the details of like launching a new customer. These case studies can get dense. They can get technical, or they can be really floofy. We'll call it really fluffy. How do you strike that balance of making sure that customer voice is shining through, but at the same point, you know, delivering a case study that actually answers the key questions that someone might have?
So I went to Customer XCon in mid-October, and mm-hmm. that was something that the case study folks chatted a lot about, and it was interesting to hear some different perspectives on that. So first of all, of course, we want to integrate the customer's own words wherever we can. So this means weaving customer quotes throughout the story so that the customer is telling the story as much as possible in their own words. Some companies are experimenting with first-person case studies. I know Influitive is using first-person case studies, and I know a few other companies are experimenting with it. So that's another way of doing it where you're saying, I did this, I did that as the customer themselves. So that's another great way to try and tackle it. I think ultimately, you really need to think about the story from the customer's perspective. This is not a marketing piece for you, the software company. This is the customer's story and the customer is the hero. So you really need to have that mindset. To go back to one of your earlier points about how do you make, how do you really answer all of those questions? Something that came up during the conference was maybe you need to have a series of stories. One is the adoption story. One is the integration story. One is you don't have a giant story. You have two or three smaller stories that can speak really specifically to certain questions, objectives, challenges at certain points in that buyer's journey.
You know, I think that's a really wise point there around the case studies that I think groups can often say, we need case studies. And that's the entire definition that they understand about, go get case studies, whatever, you know, your success team goes out, finds clients, we'll talk. But that like methodical approach to saying, this is going to speak to this part of the journey, it's going to speak to this pain point, this is going to speak, you know, to this need that we actually have to communicate, I think is always a really great idea. But for some reason, at least in my experience, in case studies, it kind of gets overrun with, who's willing to give us a number? Who can we get to do a case study? And we'll just tell that broad story instead of splitting it up like that.
I mean, to be fair, a lot of it comes down to the practicalities of budget and time. So I'll just say that as well.
Yeah, no, fair enough. You know, I think one of the things that was really kind of like a little terrifying to me was that you found that about 12% of SaaS marketers are very satisfied with their case studies. You know, so that's a pretty small number. That's actually very satisfied. It's a big push, but still that's a pretty small number. Do you have any insights into why that number is so small? Why so few people are really satisfied with their case studies?
So unfortunately, we didn't ask a follow-up question in the survey. But this year for this coming survey, we have a follow-up open-ended question to ask them why they chose what they chose. So if they chose very satisfied, okay, great. Why are you very satisfied? So in a few months, I will have a great answer for you. In the meantime, I only have my best guess at why that could be. So one thing that comes to mind for me is we all know that in the tech industry, people jump from job to job fairly frequently. And it's a pretty common human thing that when you inherit someone else's work, you're like, eh, I can do better.
Yes.
So that's one piece of it. Another piece, things change. Best practices change. You know, what we wrote a year ago may not be how we would want to present that information a year later or 2 years later, for example. So that's something else to kind of think about. And then just kind of going back to some things that we talked about before, people want measurable results, but we know it's hard to get them. So if they aren't able to get them, they're probably not going to be as satisfied with their case study. And something else that we found was that 30% of the marketers found that losing the spirit of the story during the approval process was one of the biggest challenges for them. So you can imagine if you're happy with the story, but then some of the good stuff gets stripped out during the approval process, again, they're not thrilled with the output. I also think we're all perfectionists. We all expect greatness. And so if it's anything less than great, it's not very satisfied.
Do you have any, you know, I've seen that kind of taking the spirit out or that tone out of case studies more than a few times. And, you know, maybe we'll just tie these two together here. You know, we also see in your report here that, you know, over 60% of customers are citing legal issues as a barrier. So, you know, is there a way that you would suggest that teams or at least how do you navigate that situation so you can keep the spirit in there, you can get legal approval? Are there any tips and tricks you've learned in there, or is this just bang head against wall until solution?
Sometimes, yes. You know, what I'm going to say is not anything new to folks in this area. You know, companies or people are scared of losing their competitive edge. They're scared that they're scared of how the case study is going to be used. They're scared of what's going to be written about them. So anything we can do to kind of alleviate those fears is helpful. So for example, always set expectations. Tell them exactly what the process looks like, how you're going to do it, what's expected of them, and what they can expect the output to be. Show them examples of other case studies that you've done or other promos of the case studies, because we know that it's not just one case study. We're going to be promoting it in lots of different ways, like social, for example. So they need to also know what that's going to look like on social. Of course, there's the option of anonymizing sensitive data, if that makes them more comfortable, or speaking about the results in a more general way. Now, we always want to aim for like concrete and specific, but sometimes we need to slide down that continuum a little bit. They need to know that nothing's going to be published without their permission and that they will have every opportunity to review it and negotiated changes, et cetera. As you mentioned earlier, you know, they could use percentages instead of concrete numbers. These are all negotiation tactics, right? Because if it's a really good story, you're going to want to tell it. It's just a matter of how can we get to the finish line? You know, at the end of the day, you could anonymize the whole story.
What do you take on that? Because I've seen it's done by a few people in my industry where they release anonymous case studies. And it doesn't land well with me, but maybe that's just because I'm a cynic at heart when it comes to some of this stuff. What's your experience around that?
I think there are some industries like cybersecurity where you're going to be hard pressed to find a named logoed story. No one wants to tell the world about data breaches that caused them to look for new software, for example.
Fair enough.
I don't know. Honestly, I mean, if you've got a big enough, important enough customer, but they just don't want their name on there, you're gonna anonymize it. And hopefully you can use a descriptor of them that makes people kind of know who they are anyway. They're going to have to approve it. But, you know, how many multi-million dollar XYZs are there? I think it's fairly easy to kind of, through the description, help people figure out who it is that you're talking about. It's not ideal, but...
I hear you there. And I do appreciate in some industries where this is going to be much more the norm, maybe it is less of an issue than in other issue or other industries where it seems much more normal. You mentioned, you know, the idea of mass content creation, AI and whatnot. You also, you know, have lots of great insights from this report, plus all the work you're doing. So I'm really curious, kind of what innovations, what kind of changes in the future do you see for the world of case study? You've already mentioned like first persons, but I'd love to just kind of get your sense of where's the world of case studies evolving to.
I wish I had the magic ball with clear answers, but I don't. Some things that are on my radar for sure would be, you know, the first person. I would love to find a company that's willing to experiment with that with us. And I'd love to see other companies just try it as well. It's not common, but I think it's an interesting concept to try out. I think that things are going to shift towards more video. Right now, from our survey for 2023, we found that 58% of case studies have both text and video. So just over half of the stories have both the written story and the video. I think that over time, that's going to get closer to 100%, where we have almost close to all of the stories with both text and video. There's lots of video options coming out now that are more self-serve. They're very cost-effective. You know, gone are the days when you have to spend $5,000 to $10,000 on a video case study. There are other options out there. So that's something to keep an eye on. I think that people are going to start experimenting with a few other formats. So infographics showed up in our survey as something that people want to try to do more of for their case studies, as well as compilations. So an ebook of that has compiled several case studies that follow a similar theme or a use case or something like that. And then I think there's going to be a move towards telling different kinds of case studies. So we touched on this earlier. So there's the traditional challenge solution results. There's also the implementation story. So how the customer implemented the solution, or an adoption story, how the customer learned the new solution and put it to work for them. There could be a use case story. So how the customer is using the solution in a specific way, or a switcher story, why the customer moved from a competitor to you. And finally, best practices or advice from a customer. We're seeing this from some companies in the form of like a how-to guide, but told from the customer's perspective.
That's a lot. That's a lot going on in the industry. I mean, I think the video is a really interesting one. People have been pushing for video case studies for a really long time. And I appreciate, you know, there's the new kind of technology coming out there. What's your view around the idea that we're all getting a little more familiar or comfortable with, we'll call it creator style content. We'll call it like less studio production video content and more real life captured content. Do you think that influences our willingness to do these kind of case studies, or are you still seeing those 50% of case studies very highly polished in your experience?
Right now, they're still pretty polished. They're still expensive. I think that people are using those video software programs for short testimonial type clips. But I think it will shift there eventually. Social media is driving this. People are filming themselves all the time. So why not? I think it will move there for sure.
No, that makes sense. Well, that's a lot going on in the case study space. Like I said, I guess, you know, one of the things that I would kind of switch gears on us here a little bit, because, and you mentioned this quickly, but I think this is kind of the meta layer to our story here today, is a little bit also around the benefit you've got from doing this research. And you kind of saying the SEO has been big. I'm really curious, kind of, you know, I've seen so much great content produced in my life that's just got the worst distribution. That's just like, we wrote great stuff. We put together a report, you know, I don't know, we built it, they will come. What's been your experience and your strategy for developing those backlinks, for developing that organic, like that SEO value from it?
We have been cutting up our report and repackaging it and promoting it the entire year. Sometimes I think, oh God, people are going to like hate me if I do one more post about this damn report. But I have to keep reminding myself, people are not seeing every post of mine, not even close. And, you know, how many people are going to read the whole report? I don't know. I'd love for lots of people to, but I can also just take one question and the response and the recommendations. And that is a piece of content in and of itself. And it's a more snackable bite for people. So it is the foundation for our whole content strategy for the year.
That's amazing to think that you've kind of create one report and then you can really run an entire year's content strategy off that. And that's wild. I mean, it's also, I would hope, somewhat cost effective as you're kind of continually reworking the same piece. But that's just really exciting to hear that you're able to do that.
I have a really small team, so I need to be as efficient as possible. And so it definitely works for us. From a cost perspective, from a time perspective, and you know, how many pieces of original content is realistic for any company,
right?
Really, over the course of a year, you know, one or two maybe. I am hoping next year to add a second study, and that would be more so probably around lead magnets, like white papers and ebooks. Because we do have two kind of core areas. We have our audience of customer marketers for case studies, and then we have our content marketing audience for blog posts and lead magnets. So I've been neglecting the other side for a while. Yeah. So if I can swing it, I'm going to try and do another research report next year on probably ebooks and white papers.
For sure. That makes sense. And I think kind of cool to see that you'd be able to focus on one piece, like you were saying at the very beginning, you know, niche in focus, and you're just kind of, you know, logically expanding what you're working on there. I've got two last questions for you here before I let you go. And the first one's, I think maybe, you know, a kind of a funny one that I've run into a few different times, but, you know, you're doing a lot of work on case studies and also on lead magnets. When you look at the report data that you've got, how closely does it align with yourself? You know, do you find yourself having these same challenges, or do you have some wizard powers, or how does that work?
That's funny. Certainly we feel the pain of some of them, but I think the thing to remember is that we, as an agency, we are not our audience. So we aren't customer marketers at a software company. We are case study writers at a content agency. So it's a little bit different. We are not directly faced with the challenge of getting legal approval, for example. That is our target audience's challenge. So some of the questions are not relevant to us. They are directly relevant to our audience. Certainly, you know, we still face the same challenges of getting metrics, for example, because we are working on behalf of our customers to get those metrics. So no magical powers, I'm afraid, just hard work.
Fair enough. Well, with that, then I would ask kind of, you know, if there was only one piece of advice that a listener could take away from this show today, you know, they've been tasked with developing case studies for the organization. What would that kind of key piece of advice that you would kind of give someone listening today be?
I think it's important to create repeatable processes for your case study production to make sure that you can scale and save time and energy. It's a big undertaking to create case studies, and the more processes you can put around them, the better. So think about things like guidelines for what makes a good story. You know, when you're reaching out to all your CSMs to say, hey, do you have any happy customers? You need to give a little bit more direction on the specifics of what kind of story it is that you're looking for. What are the criteria? So write that down so that it's clear for everybody. Maybe create some email templates when you're making the ask to customers to participate. You know, it's so nice to be able to copy and paste and plop it in and tweak it a little bit and send it off. Think through carefully, you know, what information do you need to get from the CSM or the account manager in order to tell a comprehensive story? What is your standard list of interview questions that you can then customize for each individual story? Of course, you're going to want a case study template. So, you know, from a design and layout perspective, what chunks of information do you need? Are you going to have the three metrics up top? Are you going to have like an at-a-glance section? Are you going to have a pull quote? Make sure you have that locked down so everyone's really clear on what are the different components that you need. And then, of course, just be really clear about what the review and approval process looks like.
Makes sense. Now, if someone, let's say, didn't want to do all that and wanted to get in touch with you, how would someone find you? What's the best way to connect with you?
So go to our website. It's upliftcontent.com, or you can find me on LinkedIn, Emily Amos.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, Emily, I've really enjoyed our conversation here today. I really hope our listeners learned as much as I did. I just want to thank you very, very much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I hope to have you back.
It was wonderful to be here. Thank you for asking me.
Thank you for tuning in to another amazing episode of The Advocacy Channel. Join us next time as we bring on more great experts like Emily. If you like what you heard and would like to support The Advocacy Channel, please review, rate, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about customer marketing, head over to the Sasquatch blog or follow us on LinkedIn. The links are in the show notes. If you're looking to create powerful customer marketing programs that'll help you better activate, engage, and retain your customers throughout their entire journey, head over to sasquatch.com through the link in this episode's description and learn more about our referral loyalty and rewards platform. Well, that wraps up another episode of The Advocacy Channel. We'll see you real soon.